Good afternoon. Thank you for joining us here at the Heritage Foundation in our Douglas and Sarah Allison Auditorium. We, of course, welcome those who join us on all of these occasions on our heritage.org website. For those in-house, would you please check that cell phones have been turned off as we prepare to begin? It's always helpful for those recording the events. And of course, for those on the internet, they can submit questions via email, simply sending those questions to speaker@heritage.org, and we will include them with the rest of the written questions that we're accepting today. Opening our program on behalf of Heritage is Rob Gordon, our Senior Advisor for Strategic Outreach in the External Relations Department. Rob establishes and builds working relationships with new audiences and potential allies in championing ideas and policy solutions. Before joining us at Heritage in 2008, he directed several conservation organizations. From 2003 to 2006, he served on committee staff for the House Committee on Resources, where he helped craft the Threatened and Endangered Species Recovery Act. He has also assisted in the committee's oversight and investigative duties. In 1989, he founded the National Wilderness Institute. He has managed and research and litigation and testified numerous times before House and Senate committees on environmental policy matters. From 97 to 2002, he served two terms as a member of the Commonwealth of Virginia's Board of Conservation and Recreation, and he has also played instrumental roles in Grassroots Endangered Species Coalition and the Environmental Issues Council. Please join me in welcoming my colleague, Rob Gordon. Rob?
Thank you, John. Thank you. Good afternoon and welcome again to the Heritage Foundation. Today's program, Climate Change Reconsidered, Science the UN Will Exclude from Its Next Climate Report, is going to be conducted in a discussion format, as I assume you've noticed. The participants will address the recently released Climate Change Reconsidered 2 Physical Science. This study was produced by a team of 40 scientists, and is the newest volume of the Climate Change Reconsidered series produced by the Heartland Institute and members of the Non-Governmental Panel on Climate Change. Leading the discussion today will be Joseph Bast. Joe is president and CEO of the Heartland Institute, a 29-year-old nonprofit research center located in Chicago, Illinois. He is the author or editor of numerous books and policy studies on climate change, including being co-author of Ecosanity, A Common Sense Guide to Environmentalism, published in 94 and 96, and co-editor of the first two volumes in the Climate Change Reconsidered series. Today, Joe will be interviewing Dr. Willie Soon and Dr. Robert Carter. Dr. Soon is an astrophysicist and geoscientist. Since 1992, he's been an astronomer at the Mount Wilson Observatory. He is receiving editor in the area of solar and stellar physics in New Astronomy. He is the author of The Maunder Minimum and the Variable Sun-Earth Connection, published in 2004. His work on solar forcing of climate has appeared in many peer-reviewed journals, including Climate Research, Geophysical Research Letters, Energy and Environment, EOS, and Journal of Climate. Dr. Robert Carter is a marine geologist, paleoclimatologist, and environmental scientist who has held tenured positions at the University of Otago and James Cook University, Australia. At James Cook University, Dr. Carter was professor and head of the School of Earth Sciences. He is the author of several books, including Climate, The Counterconsensus, and Taxing the Air. He has published widely in peer-reviewed literature and was an expert witness in the United Kingdom High Court case of Dimmock versus Her Majesty's Secretary of State for Education, the 2007 judgment that identified 9 major scientific errors in Al Gore's film, An Inconvenient Truth. Please join me in welcoming Joe Bast, Willie Soon, and Robert Carter.
Well, thank you very much, Robert. And we go way back to, I remember visiting you in your office, and you had this big aquarium and a terrarium. And yeah, you had all kinds of crazy things growing in your office. It was kind of scary at the time. So I am Joe Bast. I'm the president of the Heartland Institute. Global warming is a huge issue. Arguably, it's the biggest public policy issue of our generation. Developed countries all around the world have already spent trillions of dollars trying to reduce emissions or doing other kinds of conservation activities in the name of trying to stop global warming. The impact on emissions so far has been trivial, and as these gentlemen will explain, the impact on climate has been probably unobservable, so small as not to be measurable. But if the advocates of the global warming hypothesis have their way, we will spend trillions and trillions of dollars more, perhaps hundreds of trillions of dollars, trying to address this issue. So when a group of scientists from around the world come together and release a 1,000-page report that says the impact of human activity on climate is very small, much smaller than we had thought, and that the impact, if there is one, is probably going to be as beneficial as it is harmful, you would think that various interest groups would be quick to announce this study or discuss it with the authors or give it some attention. You would think the mainstream media would want to cover this. Well, in fact, not a single mainstream media outlet has covered the release of this report yet, except for Fox News. You would think environmental groups would be rather pleased with this if their goal is to protect the environment. This is good news. This means that the human impact is less than what we had feared. It means we don't have to spend trillions of dollars chasing molecules in the atmosphere. We can spend it protecting lions and tigers and bears, if we like. But in fact, none of the environmental groups are pleased with this study. Even industry has been very silent on this debate. So this is an unusual issue. Among science issues, usually skepticism is worn as a badge of distinction. A scientist thinks that he's supposed to be skeptical of everything. In the NASA headquarters, there was the famous sign that said, "In God we trust, all others must bring data." Okay, that's skepticism. But in the global warming debate, we see a weird perversion of that. We see skepticism is actually scorned, and not just by outsiders, but on the editorial page of Nature and Science and all the leading science journals. Consensus is suddenly elevated. This is what is supposed to drive the scientific debate on global warming. But where does consensus fit into the scientific method? It doesn't. 10, 15 years ago, I'm not sure you could have found a real scientist who would have said that we're supposed to elevate consensus over experimentation. So it's a very strange kind of debate. I think there's two reasons for that. One is global warming isn't just or even necessarily importantly a science debate. It's a social movement. It's part of the environmental movement. It's part of a mega trend that's been going on for decades. It's the latest riff in environmentalism. That has had past rifts like pesticides, the ozone layer, all these kind of crisis of the month things that come and go. Global warming is the latest in that. And as a social movement, it doesn't respond to scientific research and facts the way that a truly scientific debate would. And secondly, it's an economic issue. So if you're in corporate America today, your PR department and advertising department is telling you that it's worth millions of dollars to paint yourself as being green, as being environmentally responsive. The focus groups and the surveys all say that if you can represent your company as being environmentally responsible and your product as a smaller negative environmental impact than the other guy, that customers are going to prefer your product. So all of the PR agencies for all of the major corporations in America are saying, go along with this. Just, you know, say, yes, we agree. Global warming is a terrible problem. We got to do something about it, and our company is sincerely trying to reduce its carbon footprint. So every company in the country, from pharmaceutical companies to oil companies to telephone companies, all claim that they believe global warming is a crisis and they're trying to be part of the solution, not part of the problem. In the energy sector of the economy, we see a different kind of argument taking place. We see the natural gas guys giving $25 million to the Sierra Club to attack coal companies, to support legislation discriminating against the coal industry. So the natural gas guys see global warming as an argument to use to handicap their competitors. We see the nuclear power industry doing the same thing against all of the fossil fuel industries. So in Chicago, we have the country's largest nuclear power utility, Exelon. And so we get full-page ads talking about how terrible global warming is and how nuclear power is the solution because it's a zero emission energy. They don't believe in the science of global warming. They don't care about it. It's their PR agencies that tell them that this is an opportunity for them to advance their interests. And of course, the solar companies and the wind companies and the electric car companies, their self-interest in this is very plain. They pour hundreds of millions of dollars into environmental groups and advertising campaigns that just reinforce this belief in global warming. So in an environment like this, the truth can be easily lost. It's hard to find. And it's hard to find good scientists willing to stand up to political correctness and be able to say, hey, wait a minute, the king has no clothes. This is not a science-based problem. So for the last 10 years, the Heartland Institute has been really privileged to work with a group of scientists who have that courage, who have been willing to stand up and say, this is what the actual science is. Very few people want to hear about it. Our project began in 2007 when the IPCC, the United Nations entity, published its 2007 report. That's this report, and a fascinating piece of scientific research. In 2009, we published a response, Climate Change Reconsidered, and it covers most of the same topics. It even quotes many of the same peer-reviewed sources as the IPCC did, but it came to the opposite conclusion, that the human impact is very small, that it's not well understood, and that the impact of some warming in the future would probably be as beneficial as it is harmful. In 2011, we published an interim report. This consists only of new research published since 2009. It's largely reviews of research appearing in the peer-reviewed literature. And then in 2013, in June of this year, the Chinese Academy of Sciences published a translation of the first two volumes of Climate Change Reconsidered. This is the first time a National Academy of Science in the world has published a withering criticism of the IPCC's science on climate change. And finally, in the last week, we released Climate Change Reconsidered 2, which is going to the printer, I think, at the end of this week. This is the manuscript form. And on the table, as you folks all came in, there's a summary for policymakers, which I hope you'll all grab a copy of and then maybe take a few extra copies for your friends and relatives because it makes for great reading. This is an amazing piece of work. And over the course of this discussion, we're going to talk about just what all lays behind this. So there's your background. I am really, really pleased to have Robert Carter and Willie Soon with me. And I suggest that we start by asking Professor Carter, what's wrong with the IPCC? Why was there a need for an alternative voice to the IPCC?
Well, thank you, Joe. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. When I needed a little heading to prepare some notes to think about today, what I was going to say, the heading I chose was Why NIPCC Matters. Why does this new summary for policymakers and this big volume of research review matter? And first, can I say a thank you to my American friends and who've brought me here all the way from Australia to participate in this activity. I'm a retired professional scientist. I'm one of these privileged people who for 45 years had a research position and teaching position at a university. And 45 years goes back a fair way, and you'd have to say that 45 years ago, science in the universities was rather different from today. And in particular, it was in no way politicized. Politics and science had no association. It's very different now. And as I struggle with the torrent of literature that comes out every week on climate change in general, I find I'm in a Salvador Dali painting. Now, you all know the painting that I'm talking about. It's the one that shows a desert landscape and a tree with branches, and draped over the tree are several watches, clocks and watches. And they're demonstrably painted in exquisite detail, real clocks and watches, but they're not. They're Salvador Dali. They're distorted, they're deformed in very disturbing ways because they look so realistic. And to be a scientist and to be participating in this debate is to find yourself inside that Salvador Dali painting. And you ask yourself, well, who's the Salvador Dali of this? Why is science being looked at this way? who is the Salvador Dali? And I'm afraid you come back to the IPCC. It's the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change that is responsible for this particular view of the science of climate change that we have. And I want to list for you the four key criteria that make IPCC or result in IPCC having that effect. The first one is this, and some of you in this room will know this, others it will come as a complete and rather astonishing surprise, which is the IPCC was not set up to give governments advice on climate science. It was set up instead to give governments express advice on global warming, and not just global warming across the board, but global warming produced by human greenhouse gas emissions. That is embedded in the Framework Charter for Climate Change, a UN statement, protocol, under which the IPCC operates. So their brief is not to look at climate change in the round, as it were. Their brief is to look expressly at the effect of human carbon, not even all carbon dioxide emissions, but human carbon dioxide emissions on global warming. So first point about the IPCC, it has a restricted brief, and that shows in everything it does. Second point, it is a political organization. It's a branch of the United Nations. But you're thinking, oh, well, there's lots of distinguished scientists that advise the... Yes, that's true. There are lots of scientists that advise the IPCC. But the IPCC is not the scientists. It's a branch of the political United Nations. And right now, next week, they're going to be gathering together in Stockholm, and they're going to be going through line by line the equivalent document of theirs that you have, the summary for policymakers, and the yay or the nay of approval does not come from the scientists, it comes from government-appointed representatives. So point one, the IPCC has a restricted brief. Point two, it's a political organization. Point three, each year in the summary for policymakers, there is a carefully crafted sentence which is the message for the world. You could call it, in Wagnerian opera terms, the leitmotif of this particular IPCC report. In the first IPCC report in 1990, let me read to you what that leitmotif was. It was the following. The observed 20th century temperature increase could be largely due to natural variability. That statement was true in 1990. It remains true in 2013. But in the interim, we've had four successive reports, with a fifth one to come in the next couple of weeks, which has increasingly ramped up the statement that humans might be responsible. And the draft statement in the latest report is now, it is extremely likely that human activities have caused more than half of the observed increase in global average temperature since the 1950s. Note, that's a statement of opinion, not a statement of scientific fact. But the key point is, it's the end succession of a series of statements where the IPCC has moved from saying, hey chaps, this could easily be due to natural variability, and now they're saying, hey chaps, more than half of the warming we've seen must be due to human causes. So the third thing about the IPCC is that their advice has become increasingly alarmist as they go along. Embedded in that, those statements, let me read you the last one again, this is the current draft statement to be approved next week, is extremely likely, they say. What do they mean by that? Well, it's extreme, no, it's not just extremely likely. They're not using English. They're using a set of terms that they have defined in quasi-probability space. And in their table, extremely likely is defined as meaning 95% probable. Now, there is no set of statistical operations that have been gone into to make these statements. This is posering about science. It's trying to give the impression that this body is full of people with white lab coats on, running around measuring things, and then very carefully summarizing this in statistically carefully stated terms. I have a term for this. It is hocus-pocus science. So the reason we live in this Salvador Dali world when it comes to discussing climate change is because the IPCC is the primary provider of advice to global governments. It is deeply flawed by four things. Firstly, it has a restricted brief of investigation. Secondly, it is a political organization. Thirdly, it exhibits increasing and unjustifiable climate alarmism. And fourthly, it is engaged in hocus-pocus science.
Okay, let's get into hocus-pocus science. Now, Dr. Soon, you're an expert on solar forcing of the climate. We've had some amazing conversations. Dr. Soon has forgotten more climate science than 90% of climate scientists, I think, will ever learn. So tell us about IPCC science. What's wrong with the IPCC science?
Here's the problem that I have with the IPCC science. You're looking at a black board, a board that is painted in black, and they're telling you that it's not black. It's actually not black. It may possibly be gray, that kind of stuff. This is why they're putting out all this hocus-pocus thing about probabilistic statement about how they actually knew from 2001 to 2013 that the probability of the confidence, our confidence in detecting carbon dioxide impact on global warming, to be 66% in 2001, increased to 90% confident, up to 95% confidence today. And please realize over that 2001 to 2013, the 12 years period, the CO2 concentration actually did rise. But yet, somehow, the global temperature, as best we can measure, just stay flat. How could an organization claim some scientific authority where you have this bald-faced evidence really go against these statements that they're making? How can you increase in confidence when actually CO2 is not shown to be caused the globe to warm, as best we can measure? So let me give a few specific examples of this upcoming report that is going to be released by Friday. The first example that I would put, again, is somewhat relevant to the sun study that I've been focusing very heavily for the past 20 to 22 years or so, which is the first statement that is somewhat look very naive, very simple, you know, that you all should get it, okay? If you don't get it, you should knock yourself on your head. This is the kind of statement that they put in there that I think constitute alarmism, which means the goal is not to educate you, but the goal is to try to create alarm as, you know, the state of fear, which is the ultimate goal, which is statement like this, which is to say, look, 120,000 years ago, we know that from Earth history and all this stuff that it was fairly warm. And then we have reason to believe, in fact, we have evidence, direct evidence, showing that perhaps the global sea level has risen by about 5 meters up to even 10 meters. That's roughly about, you know, if you want in feet, it's about 16 to 30 some feet. And then they're trying to tell you, look, over this time, during that period, the globe only warmed by about 2 degrees Celsius. The hint is, of course, they make this kind of seemingly, not, you know, some sort of not alarming statement. But what you need to realize is that I think they do a disservice to anybody who claim that they're trying to teach you or tell you something about facts and science. The reason is that they're trying to compare today that if you increase CO2, let's say the globe warm, if you double the CO2, you warm by 3C. So by implication, this is the kind of subtlety that, I think IPCC mastered this. I believe Bob would agree with that statement. The problem is that in that picture is that 120,000 years ago, the Earth orbits around the sun is a lot more elliptical than what's circular today. So it's about 4% more elliptical, slightly more eccentric, put it that way. So over that time period, the seasonal amplitude of the incoming sunlight radiation is actually 230 watts per meter square. Today, it's only 90 watts per meter square. So to try to compare and to give insinuation that this Eemian time and what the current warming today will produce 5 meter kind of sea level rise that is very popularized by Vice President Al Gore and NASA's former scientist from NASA GIS, Professor Jim Hansen, is highly misleading. There is just no possibility for us to have that much of a sea level rise. So let me get to another thing that really bothers me a lot in terms of this IPCC report. Some of you may think that we should just study CO2 molecule. CO2, hopefully everybody knows, is a molecule. But then there's a cousin of CO2, now it's called carbon monoxide. If you look carefully, the reason why carbon monoxide is not quite considered to be a serious gas that would warm the planet is basically it has a very short lifetime in the atmosphere. The most you would have is actually 2 months. But IPCC somehow now is saying that the impact from the carbon monoxide forcing will be at least 400 to 500% more than what the sun can do. This is another one of those blatant manipulations of fact that is really rather tricky. This is why we're studying this issue so carefully to try to understand what actual facts are. Let me give a final example. The final example, which is something that is IPCC is almost perfected this strategy. If you look in the report here, the chapter 3 where I work on solar forcing with my friend Sebastian Luning from Germany, if you look at, let's say, 100 or 200 of the references that we cited, peer-reviewed journal, of course, and if you ask yourself, how many of those IPCC are actually cited? Please check. You will not find more than 100 or 200 of them. They won't cite any of this. This is a strategy that is very non-scientific in my view, because these are all equally credible, equally kind of scientific nature of the discussion that just never brought to the elevation of science, of being a science. So IPCC is really practicing political science rather than any science that we think we call it science, actually. So with that, I think I'll pass it on back to Joe.
All right, that's excellent. Thanks. Let's talk a little bit about NIPSI, the Non-Governmental International Panel on Climate Change. Professor Carter, you've been involved in this for a long time. Tell us about what makes it a more credible source than the IPCC.
Well, we want to step out of the Salvador Dali painting into a super realist painting like Andrew Wyeth, for example. And NIPSI is set up to do that. So the IPCC has a restricted brief. It's a political organization. It exhibits increasing alarmism, and it practices hocus-pocus science. The NIPCC is set up to do precisely the opposite of that. It starts by the fact that all NIPCC scientists are fully independent. They are beholden to nobody. Many, being retired, are also highly experienced and knowledgeable scientists. They do not have employers sitting over the top of them telling them what they can and can't say in public. So number one, NIPCC advisory scientists are independent. Secondly, NIPCC activities are funded because obviously it takes some funding to produce a volume of this size and scope. They're funded by untied private family donations. There is no financial conflict of interest whatsoever in the money that has been used to fund this venture. The families concerned wish to be out of the public domain, so they are confidential. But there is not a dollar of what you would call industry money or lobby group money been spent on this volume. So firstly, the scientists are independent for NIPSI. Secondly, the funding is completely independent. Thirdly, NIPCC summarizes the peer-reviewed literature, as Willie has just said, about climate change, but it does it in the round. We're not just concerned with carbon dioxide emissions. We're concerned about all the possible effects on climate. To give you an example of how complex that is, it's been estimated there are more than 100 sub-disciplines of science and economics that are relevant to studying this issue. More than 100. When somebody like Jim Hansen gets up in public and the press say, this gentleman's a climate expert, that is nonsense. Jim Clement is not a climate expert. Jim Hansen is an expert on one or two of 100 sub-disciplines that are relevant to climate. Willie Soon is expert on one or two, probably different, and same with me. This is a huge, wide subject, and nobody is an expert on all of it. The NIPSI group has gone out of its way to assemble scientists who are competent in different branches, and cumulatively we get our advice that way. So no a priori assumptions are made about the fact this debate is about carbon dioxide. No, this debate is about global climate and all the influences on it, including carbon dioxide. Lastly, and possibly most importantly for you to take away with, NIPSI wasn't founded until after the turn of the century. The NIPCC had the first report in 1990, second one in 1996, third one in 2001. They were the only team on the block. With the foundation of NIPSI, from then on, there have been two players in this public debate. It's taken NIPSI time to develop a full team of scientists, as it were. So you could say with this latest compilation, we've finally reached maturity. But understand now, if you're a policymaker, you have two competing sets of expert international scientists giving you policy advice or science information relating to policy advice. And it is your job to assess both of those. Now, industry is well used to this sort of situation where it has a complex or difficult problem or a new product to design, and you will probably all have heard of the idea of red and green teams. So IBM set up a red team to develop a personal computer, and they went about it the conventional way. And then the actual IBM PC came out of another group which was funded called the Green Group, which was basically told to go away and think independently, look at this, and be the watchdog, be the due diligence on the green team. I've got those the wrong way around, sorry. The green team is the conventional team, and the red team is the team that's set up to be an honesty check or an auditory check. So we now have a situation where you have, we're tabling it today, the green team report on the table for you to consider. And next week, the IPCC will be tabling its, I've got that around the wrong way.
Okay. Green team.
Forgive me, I come from Australia, so I always get things upside down. So next week you will have the IPCC's report, which is the green team report. We're giving you the red team report today. One last comment. We'd like to think it's the red team report. It's actually the pink team report. We can't afford to be fully red. We operate on the smell of an oily rag. If you ask me, and I tried really hard, I might be able to find $10 million a year around the world, including the amount Hartman's putting in, which is a very small fraction of $10 million, might be able to find $10 million a year that's being spent on developing the independent red team view. More than $10 billion a year is being spent promulgating the IPCC's view. That's a ratio of funding of 1,000 to 1. If you would like to do something about that and you can improve the funding, the pink team will be happy to become red.
No, on the conditions, and nobody influenced what we say. I mean, that's been a tradition of what how we function as individual scientists. In fact, part of the reason why I'm extremely grateful to Hartland Institute leadership by Joe Bass is indeed they provide the first time the opportunities for people like us. I mean, I didn't know Bob Carter before, really. He just told me that he was writing something, a comments on the famous Michael Mann hockey stick, the temperature history that flat for about 1080 to 1900 and then show up like this. I mean, we were doing independent work in checking this fact because we're concerned, is this reality? Is this true? It turns out that it's not true. It's a mathematical product. It's not a measurement of anything that people imagine that did temperature history. Just because he gave away data series that everybody can make funny plot and color plot and then with even uncertainties ring, by the way, it turned out that those things are not uncertainty bar, not error bar that you think it is. This is how science has so quickly got manipulated in the standard filter of IPCC by now. I have been accused many names. One of the things that I'm very proud of being accused is basically I'm trying to secretly work together with so many of these people to try to abolish IPCC. Put it this way, I'm extremely proud of that title, if there were to be some possibility to that, because I really wish to not work on this topic anymore. I'm reluctant to really do a lot of these things because what am I? I'm just only interested in working on my science, but then the situation is so serious. The damage that will be done, especially from my aspect, Joe, is not politics, it's not funding, it's not green energy structure, it's anti-science movement that essentially single-handedly handled by IPCC with the kind of flawed leadership they have by Dr. Rajendra Pachauri. I mean, these folks are not serious about science. They've been manipulating science for far too long, for far too long that we don't speak out. Okay, I'm doing this really at my own personal risk, but I couldn't care less because science is far more important for us to speak out, not be afraid of that kind of intimidation. Because I'm one of those who really don't care for bullies. If I can put an analogy, IPCC is a pure bully, nothing but a bully. Okay, I wish them luck. I hope that they will come to some senses, perhaps try to study what other people have worked so hard, especially in terms of just one-to-one on peer review basis. Do you think that those guys can write signed peer review published paper and we could not write peer review published paper? Nonsense. It's power review that they have here. We have serious scientific conduct that is actually, we're so self-critical that I wouldn't print my name on any piece of paper if it's not of any serious quality that I believe is true, at least to the best of my ability. And guess what? Another quality, which I just mentioned to you on IPCC. If I'm wrong right now, right here, you tell me what it is, I'll change my mind, period. That's what science is all about. Not the kind of IPCC science where the CO2 level rises up, the confidence just all of a sudden still increase. I mean, please, guys, you got to stop this kind of charade. It's just too much to take. Please, Joe, you haven't even asked your question.
Amen, amen, amen.
Can I feed off that?
There you go. Dr. Carter.
There's a fifth thing. I won't repeat the four, but you get the message now, and Willie has just passionately explained that there's two different attitudes at work here. The fifth thing is this, that you're all used to being asked by friends, or if you're in the public domain newspaper reporters, is global warming happening then, Bob? Is climate change happening, Bob? These are ridiculous questions. They're understood as a sort of code. They don't actually mean is climate change happening. Of course climate change is happening. It always happens. What that's code for is a hypothesis, a scientific hypothesis, and it's the IPCC's hypothesis. And it reads as follows, that dangerous global warming, we don't care about it, it's not dangerous, that dangerous global warming is resulting or will result from human-related greenhouse gas emissions. Are you with me? That's what this discussion's supposed to be all about. That's a hypothesis. Now, in science, when you are considering a question like this, there is always a null hypothesis, the one you drop back on to test. And the null hypothesis is quite simply relates, goes way back to Aristotle, to the simplest interpretation of a given set of facts. Okay, so the null hypothesis is that the currently observed changes in global temperature, in global climate, because we do observe these changes, in animal and plant behavior are natural. They're due to natural variability. We all know that these things vary naturally. So the null hypothesis is that the changes are natural. The IPCC's hypothesis is that the changes are caused by human greenhouse gas emissions. Right. So here we've got the green team, the IPCC. Their scientists toil unceasingly to discover or provide evidence that validate their hypothesis. That is the opposite of scientific procedure. Going out to look for facts to prove. You cannot prove in science. You can only disprove. The red team or pink team takes exactly the contrary view. It examines all the evidence to try to invalidate the null hypothesis. That is what scientists do.
Beautifully said. You guys were given cards, I understand, for writing questions. If you have questions, can you put them on a card and hand them to whom? To this gentleman here who's going around collecting them? If you can keep it brief, go ahead while these are being collected. Go right ahead, please.
Firstly, you can't eliminate CO2. It's a significant minor contributor greenhouse gas at present concentration. So it's part of the discussion. Secondly, you said that you could prove to me to say that you cannot. You can show me evidence that is consistent with your idea, okay? And I'll look at that evidence, that's fine. Thirdly, what is my view as to what's going to happen? I haven't got a clue. I don't know a scientist on the planet that can tell you with a specified degree of statistical certainty whether the temperature will be warmer or cooler than today in 2020, just 10 years' time. And any scientist that gets up on a stage in front of you and says that he or she can is having you on. We do not know. I can, like you, give you ideas as to why I think it might be warmer or it might be cooler, but nobody knows.
Very good. All right, I've got a big stack of questions here. Many of them are excellent. We're going to need short answers to challenging questions.
No alternative speeches, yeah.
Good luck with that. One I can answer very fast. How many scientists are involved with your group? There were 47 scientists altogether. They are listed on the back couple of pages of the summary for policymakers with their affiliations and the countries that they're in. Do either of you know how the...
Would you like to mention some of them are IPCC reviewers?
And some of them are IPCC reviewers. I think four or five that we know for sure, and probably quite a few of them were reviewers of past reports. So how is the IPCC in its fifth report likely to deal with or explain the pause in temperature over the last approximately 16 years? Do either of you know that?
Unfortunately, I think it will be only a political answers. I mean, so far, most of the people try very hard to explain this, but please, you're not going to suggest that rising CO2, which we measure, is actually concentration is rising. I think about 8% or so over the last 15 to 16 years. And then the temperatures just pretty much stay flat, right? So I think that you can invent all kinds of whales, like, oh, the heat is hiding in the ocean, we're not seeing it, but excuse me, we have very accurate measurement from 0 to 700 meters, that kind of stuff. How does the heat penetrate in here, whereas, you know, you can find it at the bottom more? I don't know how you do that, but probably they need some real physical modeling explanation. There are many more explanations that is being offered, but I think so far everybody is just grasping for something. But then for them to keep insisting that using some weasel word that will be enough, for example, when me and Joe were interviewed on the Fox News, I'm glad they didn't put it in the news because I would be, you know, people say I'm, you know, saying too many strong words. They say that global warming is under hiatus. So I got really, really, you know, a little bit mad. I say, what is this? This is a weasel word. I don't care if you're Secretary of Energy or whatever. That is just weasel word. Please explain to us. You know, we're not politicians. We want to understand as a scientist too. So when you keep coming out with these things that you cannot explain, I think the safest conclusion is actually try to at least admit that CO2 is a weak minor greenhouse gas. Water vapor cloud dominates. If you want to study greenhouse effect, please knock yourself out. Study water vapor and cloud. This is the hardest problem because if you double CO2, ask yourself, what does the IPCC model predict in terms of the low cloud model? You have one version of the model say low cloud will increase. You have one that say it will be decreased. You have one that says that more or less didn't change. In science, if you have a proposition that you say all kinds of answer is possible, then I don't think you call it science. You shouldn't be serious about this. I mean, you don't, put it this way, we don't have the ability. Bob, bring a lot of humility to this question. It's a very complex study. One has to be a lot more careful. Sorry, it's not so brief.
No problem. Dr. Carter, who is John Spooner, and why does he produce cartoons for your latest book?
It's the other way around. John Spooner is the cartoonist for Australia's Melbourne Age newspaper, which is the large metropolitan broadsheet newspaper in Melbourne. I provided the words for his cartoons.
Very good. Should we do anything to reduce carbon emissions? You guys think there's no point at all in reducing?
Actually, I asked Vice President Gore this question. Yeah, I did. I asked him this question. What will we get by cutting CO2 emission? I guess I expect him to answer on the record that you cut CO2, the globe will cool. Maybe you will have a lot more ice, like last ice age maybe. Maybe you have I don't know, what do you want? I'd like him to say something, but he refused to answer. He invoked some moral authority on me. By the way, I can invoke moral authority back on him because you know what? You cannot say this sort of thing. He said he's trying to save the world civilization, like all of us don't care about our grandkids. These are uncalled for. Step back. Please take a step back, then have a conversation. It is the planet that we have to care for. I mean, we have something that we have to do. But then please don't prescribe solution that actually that has nothing to do with the, you know, the cure that has nothing to do with the cause, actually. So it's a serious problem. I mean, you cannot keep arguing that, you know, lung cancer causes cigarette smoking. I mean, this is ridiculous, actually. So it's just so anti-logic that, I'm sorry, it's not entertainable.
I have a list of 6 dot points here summarizing 1,100 pages of the key results from NPIC. Let me read you point number 4. Atmospheric carbon dioxide is neither a pollutant nor is it the primary forcing agent for temperature change. Rather, carbon dioxide is an overall benefice for humankind. And recent paper, a major summary paper, has shown that the increased productivity, green productivity on the planet that's come from the industrial release of carbon dioxide is of the order of 12%, I think it is, of the greening we've seen. So carbon dioxide greens the planet. It is a complete mystery to me that the environmental movement views it as a pollutant.
Bob, can I add a small little point? Because this is the number one scare story now, because the globe is not warming. They're saying, oh, you add more carbon dioxide, guess what? You're gonna make the ocean acidify, acidification. Oh, this is one of the grandest of the ideas, actually. Believe me, if it's true, I'll bow down to IPCC, that is correct, because there's no lies about this. The problem is that even if you increase more CO2, yes, you will change some chemistry in the ocean. But the kind of thing that they suggested, even with the best model, they push the carbon dioxide to even 1,000 to 2,000 parts per million, you won't change the pH, which is a measure of alkalinity or solid, or acidity of the ocean. It changed by only 0.1, 0.2 units. Okay? I mean, think about it. The ocean pH is on average about 8.3 or so on the unit, slightly more alkaline. You guys know what is the acidity of the rainfall? It's 5 point something. Are you going to outlaw rain falling down into the ocean? Are you going to outlaw especially the places where you have outwalling zone, where you have the most productive marine region? Those are all very acidic water, by the way. They don't see sunlight. They have no oxygen produced there. The acidity, that the pH level there is up to 3, 2, 4. Okay, they are upwelling. Okay, they bring up fruit. I don't know what you're going to do. Outlaw the upwelling also? It's just impossible, the kind of thing that they're trying to scare people over time. Even the picture that you saw, by the way, the picture that you saw, oh, in this tube over time, oh, it's already melted, you know, this coral shell. Please remember, if you have a chance, please ask us. I mean, Heartland has produced some report. Our friend Craig Itso has produced a very nice report on ocean acidification issue. Those are all, unfortunately, it turns out to be another huge amount of scaremongering going on, rather than any strict scientific discussion about true concern, like some kid don't have food to eat or something. You know, it's not like that. It's completely untrue.
Very good. I have
to give it to them. Sorry.
I'm asked who selected the co-authors for the report. What was the process? Fred Singer and Craig Itso were responsible for identifying the scientists who became lead authors or chapter lead authors or reviewers, and they picked the best scientists that they could find for that purpose. A related question concerns the claim of a 97% consensus. Why doesn't your research appear when other researchers try to identify a consensus of scientific opinion on this issue?
I think I'll let Paul answer that.
No, over to you.
Even though I've written a paper, I'm very bored with this nonsense. I mean, it's just too much. I mean, too much circus. Excuse the language. Because please, you got to cut it out. I don't know, maybe we have 100 people here. Please try to raise on hand, pick any issues you want. Can you find 97 people agree on something? Unless it's blackboard, of course. Other than that, I don't think this kind of thing has anything to do or have any place in terms of scientific discussion. Again, I'm focusing on science that I'm talking about, not the kind of science that is politicized.
Well, a point that should be made is that the volume you see here is peer-reviewed. Okay, it's actually doubly peer-reviewed because the volume itself is a summary of papers from the scientific peer-reviewed literature. We don't begin to suggest that everybody who wrote every paper in this volume agrees with every other paper in the volume. That's nonsensical. The idea of consensus lies with politics and deal-making. It has nothing whatsoever to do with science. When did you last hear a scientist say there is a consensus the sun is going to rise tomorrow? Ever heard a scientist say that? Of course not. A scientist will give you good theoretical reasons from Newtonian physics, and you all are the empirical testers. Every morning you wake up and the sun rises. We know the sun will rise tomorrow. It's as close to a fact as you can get, okay. So as soon as you hear somebody say there is a consensus that, you know you are dealing with an issue where the science is profoundly unsettled. The idea that a 97% consensus rigged anyway of some group of scientists is something you should take seriously in planning public policy is just risible.
This is an online question for Professor Soon. What can astronomy tell us about the cooling phase that we have been experiencing for the past 15 years or so? In addition to the sun, what other astronomical influences are you looking at?
It's a bit complicated to answer, but please, I put in my best effort to answer that specific question, by the way. By looking at, for me, it's all data-driven. Measurements, good measurements. Sometimes you have bad measurements. In my particular case, please read the last section of the chapter 3, where we try our best to put out all the empirical evidence. There are two methods to look at this in terms of the current stasis and then what best in terms of putting your best scientific view on these things. Again, I never want to predict unless you understand the system first. But the rough idea is, usual technique is, of course, you look at the system, you see whether it oscillates in some reasonable, recurrent manner, like 80 to 60 years kind of a time scale. It does that. We have evidence for that. We can also find them to vary about 1500 year time scale. The secret is that if you look at all these different stuff, they all happen to kind of peak and then started to go down. So by 2030, they all kind of in phase. So in that sense, those effects will reinforce themselves. But the most powerful evidence is actually from measurements that's done in Kitt Peak National Science Observatory in Tucson. In Kitt Peak, Arizona, where my friend was, Professor Bill Livingston, is focusing on measuring just very specific thing. Oh, by the way, it might bore you, but it's really measuring something very, very interesting, the property of that. But it is basically the sunspot umbra, the dark region where it's slightly cooler than the general region of the sun, where if you measure the magnetic field strength, let's say since 1998 or so, until today, usually any phenomenon of the sun would follow the sunspot cycle, really. But 1998 until now actually cover like quite a few cycles now. We have basically two about that. It's really systematically weakening to the point where we have never seen, I believe, in this kind of structure for at least 100 years now. So this is really a very interesting science and also interesting time. But then again, too much more extrapolation would not be helpful. But I think in general, the sun, as you all know, is a major driver, of the climate system. There's no doubt and if and buts about this. The only problem IPCC misrepresent the case is that they don't study the seasonal cycle. That's it. That's the only problem they have. They just try to subtract a sinusoid out of this and then say, we study the anomaly, the difference. But you're not studying the big elephant in the room. I'm sorry.
And I'm sure Dr. Soon is willing to discuss that at greater length after we're finished here. Quick question about EPA. EPA presented three lines of evidence for its finding that greenhouse emissions endanger human health and welfare. The first was a distinct hotspot over the tropics. The second is the late 20th century warming was, quote, unprecedented and dangerous. And the third is that climate models are reliable and forecast dangerous warming. Does your research support the EPA on any of those three?
It's not our research. It's our summary of the research of the scientific community. In the broad sense. And the answer to that is there is no hot spot over the tropics. The warming in the late 20th century was in no way unusual in either magnitude or rate. And the third point about the models, it's one thing we know about the deterministic models used by the IPCC, it is that they have not been validated and they are inaccurate. So none of those three lines.
Can either of you comment on the potential issues regarding paleoclimatological reconstructions of the 1200s that alarmists claim is hard evidence of man-made global warming? Reconstructions of the 1200s?
No major comment except to say that there are increasingly better and better techniques, which I think very interesting in terms of, let's say, even CI. You can study these little marine animals that really, really settle down into the ocean. So it's exciting in that sense. But then please remember, If you study this just trying to say that the 20th century is exceptional, I don't think that holds any water. In fact, there's a major chapter here. Craig Itzhoe is the number one person who I started to collect this evidence, this paleoclimatic evidence from tree rings, from glaciers, from sediment, lake sediment, anything you want, all kinds of isotope, all across the globe, with no any prejudgment on how it should change and not change. If you study over this 1,200 years period, clearly there's a medieval warm period. Clearly there's a little ice age. There's a warm and basically a rebound from the little ice age, because what do you want a glacier to do when they grow to the maximum size? They can't go no more. The churches is already run over by the ices, so therefore they have to retreat. Okay, we believe that it's partly related to the sun started to brighten up, giving a little bit more energy to the system. And then that's the way it started to warm. It's been warming ever since then. But then to say, as Bob just summarized for you, the key conclusion from here is that if you look in terms of anything that we can do in terms of measuring the rate of change and all this stuff, nothing exceptional in the sense that to try to imply that, oh, since starting 1951, all of a sudden that, oh, like I say, the usual story is this. The sun could change the past, but then about 1951 or so, all of a sudden, the sun decided not to do anything anymore to the climate system. This is the way they play this somewhat strange game, actually. It's just sad. It's not right. And then it's not even entertaining as a scientific hypothesis, which is the saddest part for me. Because, like I say, please, I'm only married to my wife. I'm not married to any theory. As a scientist, one ought to be very open-minded. Just forget about it if it's wrong, because there's no reputation, no pride, no nothing. Just do the work. Do the scientific work, please. Just stop politicizing science and then just stop it. Because
that's an excellent point on which to end. Terrific.
Thank you.
All we ask is that you. No, all that we ask is that you understand climate change, rather than just believe in it.
Yeah.
The entertainment has arrived. The dancing can begin.
Well, science and comedy.
I'm very disappointed. I thought I was the entertainment.
Thank you very much. You guys were great. I really appreciate it. I hope.
May I respond to the report from Greenpeace? Because I was painted there. Bob also was there. But I'd like to say that I got no hands, because in that picture, I got no hands, so I can't receive any money, please. Don't give me any money.
Well, Joe, with your last question, I was feeling for a moment that I was on the Jeopardy Tournament of Champions show, watching the paleo climatologist question over a few of our heads. But what a great panel once again. And as we promised, there are refreshments and lunch outside for everybody. And I'm sure Dr. Carter and Dr. Soon and Joe would be happy to answer other questions out there. So again, thank you very much.
Right, thank you, guys.